Hi, I'm Bruce Barber, and in this week's Yale Cancer Center Answers, our hosts, Dr. Edward Chu and Dr. Ken Miller, will discuss the recent advances in the treatment of colorectal cancer. Now, Dr. Chu is the Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center and an internationally known expert on colorectal cancer. Dr. Miller, a medical oncologist, is Director of the Connecticut Challenge Survivorship Clinic at Yale Cancer Center and specializes in pain and palliative care. Yale Cancer Center Answers is our way of providing you with the most up-to-date information on cancer care every Sunday evening on WNPR. Doctors Chu and Miller welcome some of the nation's leading oncologists and cancer specialists who are on the forefront of the battle to fight cancer. They want to provide you with help and hope from Yale Cancer Center, and they're available to answer your questions. If you'd like to submit a question about cancer to the show, please email your question to canceranswers@yale.edu or call 1-888-234-4YCC, and the doctors will answer your questions on the air in a future broadcast. And if you're interested in listening to past editions of Yale Cancer Center Answers, or if you'd like to learn more about a specific kind of cancer, all the shows are posted in audio and written formats on the Yale Cancer Center website at yalecancercenter.org. This evening, Dr. Chu and Dr. Miller will discuss colorectal cancer. Now, colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer in the United States and affects both men and women. Early detection and regular screening can detect the cancer early and lead to an excellent prognosis. Dr. Chu will review the screening, detection, and treatment for colorectal cancer today on Yale Cancer Center Answers. Good evening, doctors.
Good evening, Bruce. Today, Ed and I are going to talk about colorectal cancer. Typically, Ed and I are the co-hosts, but today it's a pleasure having him as our guest. Ed is the chairman of the International Colorectal Congress and also is the editor of a well-known journal, which is called Clinical Colorectal Cancer. So, Ed, thanks for being here today to talk about this.
Well, Ken, thanks so much for having me as your guest and to speak on my favorite subject, which is colorectal cancer.
Well, with that in mind, let's start right out, which is, what is colon cancer?
Well, colon cancer, colorectal cancer, is a cancer that involves the lower part of the GI tract, the gastrointestinal tract, and it involves the large bowel and the rectal area.
All right. Well, you know what? You were just pointing out that this is the large intestine. Why is it that colon cancer, why isn't that cancer develops more often in the small intestine, which is a lot longer, and what's the difference?
Well, it's interesting because we're actually now, I think, beginning to detect cancers of the small bowel with increased frequency. In many cases, actually, cancers that involve the large bowel can also involve the small bowel. I think one of the problems with small bowel cancers is that it's very, very difficult to diagnose, and we still really don't have great techniques in order to detect cancers that involve the small bowel.
Now, a lot of our listeners are probably wondering, you know, what causes colon cancer? Why is it so common now?
Well, it's a very good question. And again, just to place things into perspective, colon cancer is the third leading cause of cancer in the United States. So each year there's going to be about 150,000 new cases. Here in Connecticut, there will be about 5,000 new cases diagnosed each year. It's the second leading cause of cancer deaths. And there are approximately 50,000 deaths attributed to this disease each year. You know, I think what we're seeing is that the main causes of colon cancer relate to age. Mm-hmm. So we always think about family history as being the number one cause of cancer and specifically colon cancer. But by and large, the vast majority of colon cancers, I would say greater than 90%, occur in individuals greater than the age of 50.
Now, is it our diet or is it things that we're either eating or not eating or other things we're exposed to?
So, you know, it's multifactorial, but there's no question that diet plays a very key role in leading to colon cancer. So a so-called Western-style diet that is rich in red meats, kind of high in caloric content, low in fiber, low in vegetables, low in fruits. That all kind of leads to a situation that can lead to colon cancer.
Oh, with that in mind, I mean, it's a great opportunity. What are your recommendations in terms of diet, some general guidelines of how can people keep healthy?
So I think that the dietary guidelines that we think of for colon cancer really actually hold for general well-being, and that is to have at least 5 daily servings of different fruits and vegetables. So ideally high in fiber content, you know, high green leafy vegetables, which presumably have a lot of antioxidants that can prevent the development of cancer and colon cancer in this case. Try to also stay away from alcohol, which we know also can contribute to colon cancer, and also refrain from smoking.
All right. Well, thank you.
So I think in general, a good, healthy lifestyle will help to prevent colon cancer, other cancers, and as well heart disease and lung disease.
All right. I want to take the opportunity to ask you about a couple myths that I think are out there. And in fact, let's ask if these are truth or myth, women are not as at risk of developing colon cancer at the same rate as men.
That clearly is a myth, and that's false. And I think that is, unfortunately, the misperception that's out there, both on women's part, but I believe actually also on the part of physicians. And so I think, it's important to emphasize that men and women are at the same level of risk for developing colon cancer. It's interesting, about 2 years ago, during the month of March, which is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, I worked very closely with the Women's Alliance for Health, which is a major women's organization trying to reduce heart disease, lung disease. And during that month of March, we were focusing on getting the message out to women that they are at the same level of risk, and that screening and detection absolutely critical for both men and women.
All right, another one, again, truth or myth, that if there's no family history of colon cancer, then you can delay having your screening colonoscopy to age 70.
Again, that's a myth, and that's false. So we know that family genetics does play a role in the development of colon cancer, and there probably is about 15% of all the colon cancers that we see that we can definitely say is attributed to some type of genetic abnormality. But it's also interesting that as we understand the biology and the genetics of colon cancer, the remaining 85% still do have some genetics, but again, it has to do with environment, lifestyle issues, and again, as I mentioned at the start of our show, age really is the critical issue. So in individuals who have no family history of colon cancer, the recommendation that I think is absolutely appropriate and very reasonable is starting from the age of 50, screening for colon cancer, absolutely vital.
All right, let's delve into that. What is the appropriate screening for colon cancer for our listeners?
Yeah, in my view, the gold standard for screening and detection of colon cancer is colonoscopy. And so that's a fancy word for saying that usually a gastroenterologist, a GI specialist, will put a tube that has a light into the rectum, and that tube and scope will basically go throughout the entire large bowel and look to see if, in fact, there are abnormalities, namely polyps, or perhaps early cancer.
If a patient has a polyp, how does that change the screening guidelines, and is that person at a higher risk of developing colon cancer?
Well, we know that polyps generally take somewhere between 8 to 12 years to develop into a true cancer. So if any polyp is visualized by the endoscopist, in general, that polyp is removed and then examined by the pathologist. In most cases, those polyps are benign. And I think unless there is some concern that there may be some type of familial history associated with polyp formation and colon cancer, then one might need more frequent colonoscopies. But I think if there's just an occasional polyp that's removed and none of them are found to be cancer, then I think the general guidelines would apply. If negative, probably a repeat colonoscopy is not required for at least another 10 years.
Okay. So in a sense, the colonoscopy can be both diagnostic and therapeutic also.
Absolutely, because a colonoscopy can remove the polyps. So in many ways, that's prevention.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because, again, polyps form into cancer, but it usually takes 8 to 12 years. And if the colonoscopy identifies an abnormality that, in fact, is cancer, in most cases, we can actually then detect cancer at an earlier stage. And we know that if we catch colon cancer at an earlier stage, we can cure up to 90% of those individuals.
So potentially, with very, very good screening, the rate at which people are developing colon cancer and the death rate from colon cancer could drop.
Absolutely. But the real big issue and the real problem I think that we face as healthcare providers is that even in the United States, which obviously, you know, is a very wealthy society and we have individuals who are highly educated, at most 40% of the entire U.S. population undergoes some type of screening, not even the gold standard screening, which again I believe is colonoscopy. And in women, that rate is actually cut in half. So probably only about 20-25% of women undergo at least some form of screening.
That's actually sort of fascinating. That I mean, mammography has obviously been well promoted and still, unfortunately, is not uniform, which is diagnostic, finds some cancers early. But colonoscopy really could be preventative and how little it's utilized.
Absolutely. And that's why I think, you know, having a discussion like we're having this evening really is critically important. It's interesting that, you know, when I was working with this Women's Alliance, Health Alliance from Washington, D.C., and they did a number of questionnaires to see why women weren't going for screening detection. And the number one cause was that women really didn't want to go through the preparation, the cathartic preparation that's required to cleanse the bowel before the colonoscopy procedure is performed.
When people go through that, have a colonoscopy, I mean, tell us more about what you have to do ahead of time. I think not everybody knows. And for those that do know, they say, geez, that must be a terrible thing, is it?
Well, I have to say, so yours truly has undergone three colonoscopies over the last 15 years. And the reason for that is that in my own family, there is a very significant risk of colon cancer. And I have to say, while it's true, the very first colonoscopy I had, which was probably over 15 years ago, the preparation was not so pleasant. I can say now that the whole process has improved dramatically, so that really there should be nothing to worry about in terms of the preparation. One takes actually what's called Fleet's Phosphosoda. They actually have different flavors now.
Uh-huh.
I actually think it's fairly reasonable. You go into the... So you take these preparations, you basically poop your bowels out. I hope I can say that. You go to the GI suite the next morning. They give you a medicine, and then you're out. And the next thing you know, you're in the recovery room. So it's really a very, very benign procedure.
All right, so it's a great opportunity to please remind our listeners, if you haven't had a colonoscopy and if you're supposed to have one, please do, because it's very important, and tell your family and friends. We'd like to remind you to email your questions to us at canceranswers@yale.edu. We're going to take a short break for a medical minute, and then please stay tuned to learn more information about colorectal cancer with Dr. Ed Chu from the Yale Cancer Center.
It's estimated that over 2 million men in the U.S. are currently living with prostate cancer. 1 in 6 American men will develop prostate cancer in the course of his lifetime. Yet major advances in the detection and treatment of prostate cancer have dramatically decreased the number of men who die from the disease. New treatment options now provide hope for men diagnosed with prostate cancer. Screening for prostate cancer can be performed quickly and easily in a physician's office using two simple tests, a physical exam and a blood test. With screening, early detection, and a healthy lifestyle, prostate cancer can be defeated. Clinical trials are currently underway at Yale Cancer Center, Connecticut's federally designated comprehensive cancer center, to test innovative new treatments for prostate cancer. Patients enrolled in these trials are given access to experimental medicines which have not yet been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute, brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Ken Miller, and I'm here with my co-host, Dr. Ed Chu, and we're discussing the latest information on colorectal cancer. Ed, let's talk about treatment. If someone has a colonoscopy and they find a colon cancer, how is that usually treated?
Well, so again, typically colon cancer is approached in a multidisciplinary fashion. So once the diagnosis of colon cancer is made, typically the first person that individual would go to would be to see a surgeon who specializes in GI malignancies. But in addition, that individual would probably also see a medical oncologist, such as myself, and a radiation oncologist. And again, to try to have, you know, a different perspectives on how to approach an individual patient.
Now, here's a question that comes up from a lot of patients who are about to undergo surgery. I think it's important to put it out there. They say, geez, you know, if I have surgery and the air is exposed, the tumor is exposed to the air, it spreads. Is that a truth or myth?
I'll have to say it's part truth and part myth. I think the important point to emphasize is that cancer, by its nature, is usually a systemic disease even at the time it's diagnosed. So even though we believe that colon cancer, if caught early, is only locally involved, mm-hmm. what we're now finding actually is that in patients who have early stage colon cancer, they can benefit from what we call adjuvant chemotherapy. So after the surgery is done, generally you wait then 4 or 5 weeks for the patient to recover. We then give usually up to 6 months of chemotherapy afterwards. And the reason for that is to prevent the cancer from coming back where it was originally found, but also to prevent the cancer from recurring at other sites throughout the body. And the reason, again, for that is even before the surgeon has gone in, those tumor cells, which are actually pretty nifty, have a way of getting into the bloodstream, and they can find their way throughout different parts of the body.
So is it the surgery itself that causes the cancer to spread, or you're saying that actually the nature of the cancer?
It's really the nature of the cancer. And the cancer has a way of making new blood vessels to then actually leak out into the system and then proliferate at different places. And that's a process called angiogenesis, which we now know is critical for colon cancer and for other cancers.
Now, with that understanding of angiogenesis and other things that cancers need to grow, what has happened in terms of our treatment options for patients?
Yeah, it's really quite remarkable, and I'm glad you asked that question, Ken. Really, over the last 3 years, because of our understanding of the biology and the genetics and our understanding of what really turns on these colon cancer cells, there now has been the development of what's called targeted therapy. So agents that actually target specific pathways that we now know are critical to maintain the growth of these colon cancer tumors. And so I just mentioned this angiogenic process, which is the requirement for tumors to have their own blood vessels to grow. And so 2 years ago, actually now 3 years ago, the folks at Genentech developed a very novel antibody called Avastin, which actually targets blood vessel formation.
So some of these drugs have been used in patients with advanced colon cancer where it's come back. Are they, and they've been found to be very helpful, very exciting, are any of them being moved into the post-operative setting to prevent recurrence?
Yep. So as you say, obviously usually when we develop treatments for colon cancer and for other cancers, we generally start in the situation when the tumor is in advanced stage. And again, so Avastin actually was shown about 4 years ago to significantly improve the clinical benefit of traditional chemotherapy. We're now actually doing a number of clinical trials in patients who've had the colon cancer removed, and then to see if the addition of Avastin, and then there's another very interesting targeted therapy called Erbitux, which targets a different pathway, the epidermal growth factor pathway. So both of those agents have now been combined with standard chemotherapy drugs in the adjuvant setting. Unfortunately, it's still going to be probably at least another 2 or 3 years before we have the data to tell us whether or not those treatments are in fact effective.
Do you want to give us your educated guess? Do you think these things will help?
My hope would be that they will help, because obviously if they can help in situations where the tumor is more advanced, you know, the intuitive feeling is that they should be more effective when the tumor bulk, the tumor size is much, much smaller.
Now, on a day-to-day basis, when you see a patient who's already undergone surgery, what do you think about in terms of making these decisions with them in terms of post-operative treatment? What type of chemotherapy, how long, et cetera?
So I think it's, you know, obviously we have to base our decisions on the data. We have to look at the patient characteristics. So what is their overall performance status? You know, do they have any associated illnesses that perhaps might make it more difficult to treat or might make them more susceptible to toxicity? You know, a number of the different treatments have different side effects. And obviously, I think now that we have more choices and more treatment options, it's critically important to have patients tell us what type of side effects they're willing to experience.
Along those lines, you know, I know that you have a particular expertise in terms of working with some of the new compounds to try to reduce toxicity and also to increase the effectiveness. And please tell us some about that.
Yeah, so I'm very glad you asked that. So as you know, I've had a longstanding interest in developing Chinese herbal medicine and to really kind of bring it into the mainstream. And what we found, actually, my colleague, Professor Tommy Chang, who is my co-director in the Developmental Therapeutics Program here at the Yale Cancer Center and a leading pharmacology professor here at Yale and throughout the world, Tommy's group actually was the first to show that a Chinese herb that had been used for over 2,000 years in the Orient to treat everyday diarrhea actually could, in fact, reduce the side effects associated with a number of different cancer drugs. And at the same time, at least in the animal systems, could also enhance the tumor-killing effects of chemotherapy. And so we've actually already done three different clinical trials in patients. And at least in one study, looking specifically at colon cancer, we found that this Chinese herb could indeed reduce the nausea, vomiting, diarrhea associated with chemotherapy. And we're about to actually embark on two additional studies, one in colon cancer in combination with chemotherapy, and another one, actually, our colleagues in radiation oncology, Susan Higgins, is planning a study combining this Chinese herb with radiation therapy to treat patients with advanced ovarian and cervical cancer. And the idea is to try to reduce the diarrhea associated with radiation therapy.
I found it very interesting, the idea of fingerprinting, which, you know, typically we think of as, you know, as something criminal. But tell us about fingerprinting in the laboratory.
Yeah, so what again, Professor Chang's group has done is to be able to do a fingerprint analysis or profile of all of the ingredients within this Chinese herb and others. And the big issue, I think, that we have to deal with respect to herbal medicine and herbal medicine in general is the quality of preparation and the consistency of the preparation. And I think what we're hoping to do is to bring this type of Chinese herbal medicine into mainstream medicine. And just like what we have to do for every other drug and to ensure the high quality of the product and the safety, we have to do the same thing with Chinese herbs. And so it's really quite fascinating. So within this main Chinese herb that we're dealing with, there are four key products, but within those four key products, there are up to an additional 90 to 100 individual ingredients. But we now know through this fingerprinting profile what each of those ingredients is.
We did receive an email from Barbara, who lives in Stamford, and she writes here that her father has metastatic colon cancer and is wondering what's on the what's available now and what's on the horizon in terms of treatment, and also what's available at the Yale Cancer Center.
So I think, you know, we're very excited about how we approach patients with metastatic colorectal cancer, and the advances that we've seen have just really taken place over the last 6 to 8 years. And so there are now a number of very active treatment options that are available that include traditional chemotherapy along with the so-called targeted therapies, either Avastin or Erbitux. In fact, I just came back from our big annual clinical oncology meeting in Chicago, and yesterday at one of the big symposiums, there was a very fascinating talk reporting on a study in Europe that shows that chemotherapy combined with Erbitux, which targets the epidermal growth factor receptor pathway, can actually result in increased shrinkage of tumors and actually can prolong the disease from coming back and spreading.
Has the prognosis for patients with advanced colon cancer improved?
Yeah, so while we're not at the 5-year cure yet, the median survival is upwards of 26, 28, 30 months, which is really quite remarkable because back when I started as a fellow in and as a junior attending, our median survivals were only on the order of 8 to 10 months. So we've seen a significant improvement in our ability to treat patients. Colon cancer is now a chronic disease, and so there are just so many different types of treatment options in different settings.
I have to say it's very encouraging, and it sounds like things will continue to improve.
Absolutely.
Well, how can someone listening or access this kind of cutting-edge treatment at Yale and elsewhere?
Well, obviously, I think if anyone's interested in clinical trials, and we do have here a number of very interesting clinical trials that we're about to open here for colon cancer that involve the combination of targeted therapies. And so they can, I think, go to our website, that's yalecancercenter.org. Also, one can also go to the NCI website, which is www.cancer.gov, which actually would give a complete listing of all of the trials in colon cancer, not only here at the Yale Cancer Center, but throughout the country.
And as we're wrapping up, any last recommendations you want to share with our listeners?
So I think colon cancer is highly preventable, it's highly curable, and it's highly treatable. And again, the take-home message is that if we can detect colon cancer at an early stage, we can cure it. So again, for those out there, get your colonoscopy. Absolutely critical.
And for those people who have been diagnosed this month and next month and in the future, what's the outlook for them?
I think the outlook is really tremendous. And the key would be to go to physicians who know how to take care of colon cancer.
Ed, I want to thank you for joining us and talking about this very important issue of colorectal cancer.
Until next week, this is Dr. Ed Chu
and Dr. Ken Miller
from the Yale Cancer Center, wishing you a safe and healthy week.
Thank you, Dr. Chu and Dr. Miller. If you have questions for Dr. Chu, I encourage you to go to yalecancercenter.org for more information about cancer and the resources available to you. You can also listen for past editions of Yale Cancer Center Answers in audio and written formats on the Yale Cancer Center website at yalecancercenter.org. And remember, tune in to WNPR every Sunday evening at 6 for Yale Cancer Center Answers for the latest information on cancer care and treatment. On next week's show, Dr. Chu and Dr. Miller will discuss screening, detection, and treatment of sarcomas.